gentlemen, may I have your attention?
There are some very scary parallels with the AIDS pandemic and now with the COVID. There are some issues that were never really dealt with the AIDS pandemic that are beginning to peek their heads right back at us. And unfortunately, right in the middle of all of this are youth, because they happen to be, on any given generation, the most impacted by the offshoots of any given pandemic.
Comunidad, welcome to another episode of Our Cultura, a Radio Teco podcast of the legacy San Francisco-based community bilingual newspaper, El Tecolote. My name is Alexis Terrazas, editor-in-chief, and in a few moments, I will be joined by LGBTQ artist, activist, and director of El Colectivo del Rescate Cultural, Juan Pablo Gutierrez. For the last 40 years, El Colectivo has organized San Francisco's Día de los Muertos ritual procession. In this episode, we discuss how the ritual procession came to be, the impact and influence that the AIDS pandemic of the 1980s had on the ritual procession, and how we honor nuestros muertos during the era of COVID-19. Okay, and now it's time to kick this conversation off with the executive director of El Colectivo del Rescate Cultural, Juan Pablo Gutierrez. Juan Pablo, please, first and foremost, the most important question of today, how are you doing today?
Actually, I'm very happy to be here because I made it on my own volition. It's been difficult getting out of bed, but when you called, I couldn't say no. It was an opportunity that I couldn't pass up because I rarely get to talk with you. And for some reason or other, I feel like we're in South Africa. We're digging for diamonds because we always come up with really important things, particularly about the history and of this community, the Latino community of San Francisco, and what it means, not just within a historical context, but what it means to today.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, like, Dia de los Muertos has picked up in enormous popularity over the last few years. You have movies being made about it, but this is a really special milestone, the 40th anniversary of the Dia de los Muertos San Francisco procession. And before we kind of get into, like, our deeper topic, I want you to, if you can, just provide a little bit of background information for some of our audience members tuning in who don't know. Tell us about the history and what the San Francisco Dia de los Muertos procession is all about.
It's very difficult to talk about the history of the Day of the Dead because there is no se puede separar el concepto original a los conceptos abortados sobre el Día de Muertos. El concepto original era de celebrar la tradición del Día de Muertos latino. Y el otro paralelo existe donde entran grupos interesados específicamente en promover sus propias organizaciones o sus propios intentos políticos sociales through the use of the Day of the Dead. So, as we look and separate those two, I want to take you back to last week. I took a drive with a very good friend of mine, Emmanuel Montoya, the printmaker, and we had made it a date to go, and this date that we made was several months ago, to go visit Yolanda Lopez. And Yolanda lived at the same house that I lived at for many years, along with our poet laureate, Juan Felipe Herrera, and Rene Yanez, and Baby Rio. I mean, how many diapers didn't I change? Forget it. That's why I never had any children of my own. But we had made an appointment, and so we finally drove out to and parked in front of the house and said a prayer for Yolanda. El edificio ese used to be called La Sirena because it was painted green and it was two stories high. Y arriba vivía yo con Francisco, Yolanda, and Rio. Y abajo vivía Juan Felipe Herrera y Margarita, his writer wife. And then eventually, the reason I brought us to last week was I was telling Emmanuel, I remember when we brought Rodrigo Reyes' coffin down those stairs because we decided to not tell the funeral home that we had the body at the house until late in the afternoon. So we began to talk about what was it that brought us together as artists to celebrate the Day of the Dead. And so the celebration basically began as a procession to attract people to attend the exhibit at Galería de la Raza. And it was started by Ralph Maradiaga and René Yáñez. But the explicit focus of that was to get people to go to the Galería exhibit of the Day of the Dead. That's when we started. We started to doing a ritual, the traditional ritual that is done invoking the five directions. And we kind of like grew up together. And that's why we're celebrating our 40th anniversary. Because we've never received money from corporations. We've operated as a collective. And we've operated under the model of our dead are not for sale. And como nuestros muertos no se venden, no aceptamos product sampling, no aceptamos la promoción de ideas o ideologías que vayan a causar problemas, especialmente con nuestros jóvenes. So let's look back at the AIDS pandemic, specifically as it relates to the Day of the Dead.
Yeah, that was actually going to be a follow-up question of mine, you know, because I remember you and I have kind of briefly talked about that. But what are, you know, for generations, San Francisco has been viewed as like a sanctuary almost, right, a lot of gay folks. And and so what are the roots or how did the AIDS pandemic contribute to the San Francisco Dia de los Muertos procession?
Well, part of it is invariably linked to the vast number of creative people that we lost as a result of the pandemic. And the biggest telltale sign happens to be El Tecolote newspaper, because anybody who's ever been anybody or pretends to be somebody has passed through here. And if you look at the number of writers, the number of copy editors, the number of actual graphic designers that we lost to this pandemic, is we can't count it because we were so busy doing the stories. We were so busy working that front line that we never took the time to stop to count the dead because we were so busy burying them and then so busy doing the work like yourself now. One of the main pieces that never got dealt with the AIDS pandemic is the issue of grief. If you look at the numbers of suicides during that time frame of Latinos and Latinas, especially youth, the numbers are astounding because we never provided during the AIDS pandemic the tools for a young person to deal with death. Or understand that you're not powerless, to not feel like you don't have access to anything. There's very specific tools that we can provide our youth that most cultures do not. Just the fact that they don't celebrate their dead is a big no-no. In that, if you go to my house, it's normal to see los tíos y las tías que se han ido, and we remember them, and it's normal. There's nothing wrong about that. But those tools, if you compound that with an organization like now, Facebook, that's telling you to look a certain way, to act a certain way, to talk a certain way, of course you're going to be pushed to suicide. So let's compare those two statistics now and what they were back then. And we're going to face the fact that those tools that were never transferred, we're still facing that right now today. In your case, you've got two young kids that are very quickly coming up. And you're probably realizing that the bulk of what they're going to learn, they're going to pick it up right now. And part of that has to be those tools, those coping mechanisms that I've seen you grow into so well. But there's parents, Alexis, that don't have the capacity to transfer that. So how do we deal with those frontline workers who are more worried about getting child care than any of the issues that we may be talking about today? So celebrating the dead goes beyond putting up a skeleton or skull or doing a calavera poem or going to a Day of the Dead exhibit. It's a lot deeper than that. And it's a lot more important because we happen to be the only open culture that deals with the subject. I've done several programs this month alone in which all the callers that have called into the programs, they want to know what's next. Where can we go get more information? What are the tools? How do we get more specific about this? And programs like this one, that's why I jumped at the opportunity to come see you, are so rare to be able to talk about these things. Then there's the larger issues, the more palpable issues. If I was to stop listening to this program right now and got on my phone, who do I call for mental health? Will there be another person on the other line? Peor, que te entienda lo que le estás diciendo. Mm-hmm. Porque en primer lugar, así como estamos acostumbrados a trabajar, we're not used to calling a shrink. We are not a culture that grew up with mental health as a resource. And so as a result of that, we're creating blockages of information, of access to technology, of basic tools that could have saved us from that precipice that it's so easy to jump into.
Yeah, and according to my math, forgive me, I'm not the greatest mathematician, but the first San Francisco Dia de los Muertos procession was in 1981, correct? Or am I incorrect?
No, it actually happened about 3 years before that, and it happened through the efforts of a bilingual teacher called Marta Estrella, and it happened in Presida Park when Presida Eyes murals still had their building up in the park. And there were approximately 50 to 75 people that gathered at the park and did a public altar and walked around the park. Then Renee came up with the idea of publicizing the exhibit at the gallery, because Amalia had just bought a house there in Presida Park, Amalia Mesa Baines. And her husband, Richard, I think was his name. And so that's how the procession literally moves into the mission. But it happened the first 2 or 3 years at Presida Park. By the time it reached the Galleria, it began to grow by leaps and bounds. So that 50 to 75 people became 150, and then it went exponentially every year. According to police estimates, we had 1 million people in 2019 here in the mission.
Wow.
But who cares about that? The people that banged my phone down trying to get product sampling tables set up either at the park where people were landing up or along the parade route. And I said, no, 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 no. We got offered up to $500,000 contract so they could set up tents and product sampling. And we said no, because our dead are not for sale.
And right around that time, you know, this mysterious disease, that was claiming the lives of many, you know, and who are one of our presidents called the Gay Plague at one point, was claiming lives. And you talked about the lack of mental health resources. How did you, as an openly gay man, Juan Pablo, how did you, like, where did you go and what role did...
I did not cross my arms and sit back. RFP, a request for proposals, was put out by the state. And so I wrote a $1 million grant for the Instituto Familiar de la Raza, and we got it. We established the first Latino community AIDS education project. And then the following year, I wrote another grant for another $1 million for the Instituto to start the Mano a Mano project. And both of those projects became national models, which were replicated in Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, and all with the training modules that were produced out of the Instituto. And I, by the way, never received one penny. I also helped Sumitomo Bank donate the building where the current Instituto Familiar de la Raza is. Again, I did not receive a penny because the idea is to support our community. And maybe I'm stupid, maybe I'm backwards, but the fact that I have never made a living out of supporting my community, I think attests to the fact that it is possible to say that you're comprometido and that the sexual preference flags really don't belong there. Mm-hmm. But let's get back to mental health.
Yeah, I was going
to
ask.
Mental health is something that is so amorphous, even to this day, in our community. When we began dealing with the AIDS pandemic, I remember I was very involved with Tom Amiano in making San Francisco a sanctuary city. We were doing a play about El Salvador that we translated of a book at the time that was on the bestsellers list of the New York Times called Un Día en la Vida by Manlio Argueta, which is now the director of libraries for El Salvador. What we were trying to do is create sentimiento público in support of El Salvador because people were dying like fucking flies. This was before the conflict in Guatemala or before the conflict in Nicaragua. I'm talking about when Crescencio Arcos was the U.S. ambassador to Costa Rica. And he baptized the kids of Oliver North. And there's all these other like crazy things happening. We were being faced with thousands upon thousands of immigrants coming to the city. They were being turned back. And where are these people being turned back to? Now we're dealing with generations of young people whose kids are now entering teenage years that would never have survived if we had not created a sanctuary city. And if you look at that concept carefully, it was gay men that created the concept of a sanctuary city. And yet, we've always been relegated, marginalized, simply because of our sexual preference. And that's where I put myself up as an example. Here, I can tell you, I work with Mission Language and Vocational School Arriba Juntos, and Instituto Familiar de la Raza, directed the Mission Cultural Center for more than 10 years, and have continued to work with El Tecolote to this day. Mm-hmm. That's an example.
Claro. And but specifically, I was going to ask about the procession and just like the whole deeper meaning of celebrating one's celebrating our loved ones that have passed on. What did that do for you when you were watching compadres and you know who were dying?
It was very painful, but it was a pain that I was able to put into context because I never saw it as something that went to waste. It was a pain that was redirected critically and in a very positive way. $2 million in less than 2 years back in the early 80s. That's a lot of money. that went to where it needed to go. When you look at the bilingual medical assistance training program of Mission Language and Vocational School, it not only became very effective, it was the first curriculum by a community-based agency that was accredited by the state. Again, becoming a national model for schools like Heald College and everybody else to start offering the program. The procession that the dead, what we do on a very private level, is also very unique because everybody wants that procession now. When you have a million people attending, literally at a call of a button, that's using social media. Because people respect you when you call, because they know they're not going to be abused. They know that their dead are going to be respected. And we were the first ones to open our arms. Yes, this is a Mexican festival, but the Irish also have dead. So do the Germans. So do the Druids. Everybody, there's the brujas, chamanes, curanderos. Todos tenemos muertos y todos lidiamos con la muerte de una manera muy especial. Pero eso no quiere decir que se pueda vender eso o que pueda entrar alguien a comercializar tus sentimientos. So, lo que nosotros practicamos básicamente es que invocamos cinco direcciones, que es muy importante en la magia, porque primero hay que entender que antes de que llegaran los españoles, estamos hablando de un continente que ya tenía millones de indios. Si se mataron 6 millones de judíos, imagínate cuántos millones de latinos no se chingaron los españoles. So, starting from that, before the arrival of the Spaniards, we didn't believe in heaven and hell. The concept of hell came with the Spaniards. They were, according to Olmec and Aztec pre-Cortesian beliefs, that the body, once the soul left, it was guided by the dog, Xolotl, through 9 stages to reach Mictlan, the land of the dead. And what I mean by 5 directions is north, south, east, west, and the 5th direction being yourself as the ether. Because how can you practice magic without invoking those 5 directions? So that's where we've gone beyond the traditional matachines and Aztec dancers, which only invoke 4. It was the gremios that believed in the concepts of the native religion before the arrival of the Spaniards, that it was you, the self, that by invoking the 5 directions, you make it whole and you close that loop. There's 2 things that are very important about what I'm saying. One, if you want to follow up on it, there's a book, an author by the name of Velasco Piña, who wrote a magnanimous book, which is like the Bible of all communist-leaning students that came out of UNAM in Mexico City, and it's called Regina. And it was about the groups of women they helped organize in the neighborhoods of Tenochtitlan for when the arrival of the Spaniards, when they actually came to the city to take over, they were the ones that organized. It wasn't the men. It was the Gremios de Mujeres. And there's a whole book written about that called Regina. And he wrote a previous book called La Mujer Dormida Debe Dar a Luz, where he talks about the mandate of the guardians of Mexican culture, and that mandate being that if Mexican culture is going to survive, it's going to survive in what we now know as Aztlán. It's not going to survive in Mexico, because it was the Aztlánecos that really adhere in contemporary times to those beliefs. So that's how we bring the whole thing kind of back into focus, that yes, we have 5 fingers, yes, there's 5 directions, and we hold steadily fast to that, and to the fact that as long we've proven for 40 years that it is possible to work as a collective, and that it is possible to survive our culture y rescatar nuestra cultura sin tener que depender de non-profit concepts or corporate structures que no funcionan.
I want to get deeper, actually, a little into this constant fight against capitalism trying to sink its talons into this collective. But real quick, two-part question, Juan Pablo. For those who might not be familiar, tell us a little bit about where you're from, who you are, and the ongoing fight to stave off these corporations that have been trying to steal this from the community.
I was born in Monterrey, Mexico, but our family has gone back and forth in the corridor between Monterrey and Austin because the current capital sits in property that used to be a big rancheria that was owned by our family. So to say that I'm Mexican, yes, I am. And to say that I'm Texan, yes, I am. Because my great-grandfather also fought against the French y la enterramos con su rifle. So there's a long history there. Then I finished my master's degree at UT Austin and worked for 10 years before coming to California with the U.S. Department of Education. We worked in accelerating bilingual education throughout the whole country and developed a program to credential Latinos education. That's where people like Cecilia Burciaga were credentialed, or Carmen Lomas Garza that I graduated with somewhere along the line. And so these are projects that happened way before I moved here. But I want to tell you an interesting anecdote that was verified to me by an artist that died a couple of years back, Michael Roman, because I was at home one day and the phone rang and it was some reporter saying, what did I think about Walt Disney wanting to copyright the words Day of the Dead? So this is answering your corporate. Yeah. So you can see how big and how fast it moves. So I go, well, Mr. Walt Disney would have probably done somersaults in his grave if he knew that the people that are inheriting his wealth and power are now trying to copyright the dead. And so I said, but we can't fight against them. And certainly if they've already submitted for copyright infringement, we don't have the money to litigate that in court. Well, a couple of days later, somehow between the time of the radio podcast, because it was a podcast, and the time that it happened, 2 days later, the American Civil Liberties Union took up the case and literally overnight had Walt Disney rescind the copyright. And you know, they had to change the name because the movie was going to be called The Day of the Dead. And they had to change the name to Coco.
That's right. Which my kids love, by the
way. Oh, no, I do too. I love it. It's wonderful. But what I'm saying is, if you don't have the money to litigate something, these corporations will product sample you out of house and home. Mm-hmm. They're already controlling what you buy, what you like, what you don't like. But that's just one example of how quick all of this moves. And it's scary. Mm-hmm. Because while we are powerless, we really actually have a lot of power. Because that one phone call telling people that at 7 o'clock, November 2nd, 2021, we're going live with a virtual program because we're not going to be infecting anybody, but we've got a couple of Uzis up our sleeve that you're going to be privy to, and it's free.
I was going to ask, so last year it was virtual. This year it sounds like it's going to be virtual once again. Again, thank you for not hosting a super spreader event. As the various, I don't know when this will air, but by the time this airs, Fleet Week will have happened, and all these sporting events will continue. So thank you for not hosting a super spreader event.
No.
But tell us about the programming this year.
Well, this year, we are collaborating for the first time with the San Francisco Symphony, who actually provided the funds to bring the curator of the Museum of Modern Art in Mazatlan, Cecilia Sanchez Duarte. And she is the curator of the exhibit that we're putting up on the three floors of Davies. And they are these 10-foot-high by 3-foot-wide Muslim prints. Mm. Imagine a gigantic print made with wood, carved out of wood, inked, and then a roller, a steamroller over it. And then these giant prints are created of the 9 stages that the soul goes through to reach the land of the dead. So Cecilia is going to be coming to talk about how the project kicked off, because it's all done by youth. And there are youth from different parts of the state of Sinaloa, which is a great plus because they don't only export cartels and cocaine. They export wonderful artwork and projects, which we certainly can emulate here. So Cecilia will be coming and we'll be taping her. Actually, Mabel's working very closely with us.
That's right.
We want to keep it all in the family. And so she's going to be taping the Cecilia's talk and also some of the altars that are there for when we go live at 7 o'clock on November 2nd. Then there's an exhibit, a very interesting exhibit happening here at, ¿cómo se llama? La de los perros? La de los perros.
Los perros.
The bookstore.
Is it Alley Cat?
Yeah.
Alley Cat.
Gatos, I'm sorry. Anyway, there's an exhibit going up next weekend. I believe the opening is on Friday, and it's called Moctezuma 500 Años. And it's an interpretive exhibit of what's happened in the last 500 years since the, because it's exactly 500 years since the arrival of the Spaniards. And then the third part of what we're doing this year is the ritual itself, which happens at 7 o'clock, but we're not inviting the public. It's just the Aztec dancers and the people doing the invocations.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to wrap up the conversation here soon. You know, it's interesting that, you know, when the procession was getting its legs, right, there was a pandemic at that time. You know, 40 years later, we're in a pandemic of our own, COVID-19, obviously. What are some of the parallels that you've seen, Juan Pablo, and what are, like, the themes that this year's procession wants to highlight?
Well, to me, the most obvious is mental health, simply because I've been involved with mental health and I've seen its effects on various generations for the last at least 4 decades. I've been the omnipotent narrator looking at that. One of the main facts as a society is that we have not put enough money, enough interest, and enough focus on dealing with those mental health issues. We didn't do it during the AIDS pandemic, and there are very telltale signs. There were larger incidences of suicide. There were family issues that were never dealt with. There are still families that remain estranged as a result of that. There are missing, literally, if you look at a bookshelf and a whole shelf is missing of tools, practical tools to deal with death and issues of death and dying, that never got dealt with. So multiply that by those many every decade, say 40 decades now, we're still missing those tools. I still, like I said earlier, if I hang up right now, where do I call? What's the number that I call to just do a reality check? Mm-hmm. But the word reality check, understanding what that means. We went to school, okay? I'm a high school graduate. Pero gente que no entiende lo que es un reality check. Mucho menos tener acceso a un psicólogo. So, es por eso que hay que abogar como sociedad para que no se les olvide those larger powers that be, that just because we're in the front lines, that means that we don't have feelings, that we don't mourn our death, that we don't have issues of death and dying that weren't dealt with and are still not being dealt with today. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Of course it does. Absolutely. And this has been a year, I mean, last 2 years, I guess, have been very difficult. I actually, you know, a personal note, you know, I'll hold it together.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I lost my mother in February.
Yes.
And she was in Mexico. And,
exactly.
Got the phone call, and I still remember it. So I don't exactly know how I'll prepare, you know, for this November.
Be happy because Gabby's name is going on there.
Thank you.
Along with Yolanda and Margarita Genera from Mission Neighborhood Centers. Y mi tía Concha de San Antonio. They're all going in there. And it's interesting. It's all been women. Most of the men died last year. But this year it's been women. By the way, you had a wonderful mother. I got along with her great.
Thank you. Yeah. I think she did all right. yeah, I think about her every day. And just to wrap up here, Juan Pablo, is there anything that you'd like to add that maybe I didn't ask or ask correctly? The floor is yours.
Well, don't forget that there is an interesting exhibit happening, and it's free. And the opening is next Friday here at Alley Cat Books on Mission and Balmy, right at the corner. And then always don't forget, we try to make everything that we do accessible and free of charge. So you have a whole program that you're not going to see at on KQED or anybody else that actually runs commercials. We are free, and our dead are free, and they're not for sale. So at 7 o'clock on November 2nd, tune on to Facebook Live and learn everything from how to cleanse yourself with a Wevel to what are the latest books to read if you want to actualize your knowledge about what we've been undergoing for the last 500 years, and how to celebrate yourself and your dead ones with music and song. Carlos Barón's coming back as he did last year.
That's right. That's right. Well, Juan Pablo Gutierrez, thank you so much for being here with us today.
A ti. Adios.
Thank you for listening to Radio Teco, the podcast of El Tecolote, California's longest-running bilingual community Latino newspaper. If you enjoyed listening to this episode and are looking for more of our content, please visit our website, eltecolote.org. And if you value bilingual storytelling and would like to support our next 50 years of community journalism, please consider making a donation or sign up to volunteer.